So I want to thank all of my presenters for taking the time and effort to come put together some wonderful talks. Now we get to ask them questions. This is always the fun part. In a judgment-free scenario. I know that we have some questions coming from the audience. Why don't we start with those, and then we'll move on to some case procedures.
Oh, really enjoyed it. I think this is primarily from Dr. Hawkins. Patients with toxic megacolon, whether it's from C. diff or inflammatory bowel disease, what do you do with the Hartman pouch part? How long, you know, is this someone who can be reconstructed later? Is that different than someone who's more debilitated? How do you manage the length and of the distal pouch?
Thank you. So I generally go to the rectosigmoid, splaying of the tinea, make sure I get the entirety of the colon, which leaves you with about a 10-15 centimeter rectal stump. Then they get better. I give them at least 6 months before I even discuss any sort of further procedure. And you want to work up. If it was for IBD, you want to make sure that this was ulcerative colitis. Either you or your gastroenterologist wants to scope the ileostomy, make sure there's no stigma of Crohn's or anything like that. You want to make sure they're nutritionally recovered, they're in a good place from their physical capacity. And then I think it's perfectly appropriate to do an ileorectal anastomosis. Or if it is for ulcerative colitis, what I would probably do is a proctectomy and a J pouch going forward. For the patient with C. diff, similar, you want to let them get over their illness. You want to see them back in about 6 months or so. You want to scope the pouch, take biopsies of the pouch, scope the proximal ileum from the ileostomy, take biopsies of both, make sure you were just dealing with C. diff and C. diff only. And then if they're healthy enough, I'd perform an ileorectal anastomosis on that patient.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Asad Taha from Lehi Clinic. In patients with possible perforation and free air, and I agree with you that most of us will operate on the basis of physiological parameters, but I do worry about whether this area at this time when they are physiologically fit, that is our window of opportunity to operate on them, and if we miss that window, then they're going to deteriorate and we will never recover them even if we operate later on. And the second question to that, is there a role to do abdominal tap to find out whether the perforation is limited or there is fecal or purulent peritonitis?
With your second question, abdominal what?
Aspiration.
So your first question first. I think it very much depends on the etiology. I think you're correct. Using diverticulitis as the example, if you have a patient that's frail, is immunosuppressed, elderly, poor nutrition, I agree with you 100%. You're much better going in while you have that window because they're not going to tolerate any sort of observation. They're just, you know that they're going to decompensate. With the other etiologies, I think it very much depends on a case-by-case basis. Cancer is never going to get better. You need to go in and operate on that. But something like a colonoscopic perforation that's small, you don't see any sort of active extravasation, they're getting better on observation and antibiotics, and they don't have any other comorbidities. I think it just very much depends on the patient in front of you. And then again, paradoxically, the older they are, the sicker they are, and I think this is your point, they're not going to be able to tolerate observation, and those are the patients you want to be more aggressive taking the operating room and fixing the problem. To your second point, I've actually thought about this a couple of times, whether you just do, you see what's in there. I take them to the OR and do a laparoscopy. Again, more likely than not, you're going to need to do something with what you find, and I think you just go in, you put a laparoscope in, see where they see stool, bile, pus, whatever, and that really is a little bit more of a better diagnostic tool because you do your tap and you find something, you find nothing, they're still sick, you're still going to end up in the operating room. So I would favor a diagnostic laparoscopy rather than a tap.
Good morning, and thank you for the nice talk. I'm Anna Arsenis from New York. My question is, a middle-aged, healthy woman admitted to ER, slightly feverish, localized pain, elevated white count on CAT scan HNG2 findings, and she has had 3 recurrences. When is the best time to operate on her?
That's a fantastic question. I think if you can get her through that immediate inflammatory acute episode of diverticulitis, get her scoped, get her, you know, as optimized as you can, you know, talk with her, and then, you know, I think that's the time to do it.
She was treated with antibiotics. She responded well, and 2 days post-admission, she's like, "Doctor, I want my surgery. I feel good. When should I operate on her?" And nobody dares to scope her, including myself.
In that case, I'd probably say 6 to 8 weeks would be my recommendation to let the inflammation settle down and to then do the sigmoid colectomy. I think that gives you the best chance of having the optimal outcomes for that patient.
So just to add to that, there's such a vast difference between taking someone to the operating room in the acute setting and then getting them through it and getting them to the elective setting. Because we're talking about a potential of having a Hartman's, a stoma, all the complications, like infectious complications, needing possibly an XLAP and all that associated with an acute setting. Even if they're, that's why sometimes we're comfortable sitting on some air within the mesentery, some perforation, and as long as the patient's not unstable, we're okay sitting because the upside is so great, getting them to laparoscopic primary anastomosis where they can go home in a couple days. It's just such a vast difference of morbidity that we try our best to talk the patients into letting us wait because the upside's so big. So.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Condell from Riverside, California. I wanted to address the role of colonoscopy in lower GI bleed a little bit more. In my training, I was taught that there's actually very little role for colonoscopy in an acute GI bleed for a couple of reasons. One, there's the idea of busting the clot if you give a bowel prep. And two, if you're unable to give a bowel prep, then usually there's coating of the colon with blood, and it's very hard to localize. So what are the panel's thoughts? My training taught me that there was more of a role in a subacute or chronic GI bleed setting. Thank you.
So a lot of these patients do intermittently bleed, and if you can get them stabilized, if the patient can't tolerate a bowel prep, then there's really not a role for colonoscopy. If they're continuing to actively bleed and they're not stable to undergo the 8+ hours of a bowel prep, then they fall into that category of not being appropriate for colonoscopy. Colonoscopy is, it depends which literature you look in. If you look in the radiology literature, the patient should go to radiology. If you look in the gastroenterology literature, they should go to colonoscopy. So it really depends on a lot of bias in the studies, what the outcomes are with the two. But colonoscopy does have a role in both diagnosis and treatment. And I think it's hard to get the interventional radiologist to come in and do an angiography and embolization if they don't know if there's a tumor present, or if we don't really know what's going on, then they're less willing to do so unless it's a true emergency situation.
Another thing is to know the resources that are available at your hospital. I mean, I know that's a clear understanding for everybody in the room, but to actually have an algorithm that you've talked to your colleagues about and set forth, because every place is a little bit different. Some hospitals are more down the angiography pathway, and some hospitals are going to be more down the colonoscopy pathway. It really depends on what you have available at the middle of the night. One question I had for the panel was for tagged red blood cell scans. You know, where I am, I have a difficult time trying to get angiography, especially at midnight, and then I'm told to get a tag scan. And so, you know, how much resistance do y'all get, or how much help do you get, I should say, that's a better way of putting it, from your colleagues when it comes to trying to get angiography done?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it depends on each institution. Yeah. We have a great relationship with our interventional radiologists, and we just talk through it. It depends all on the stability. And, you know, if they think they're bleeding fast enough, they'll come in and do it. I've never found the tagged red scan particularly helpful clinically, but if they're not bleeding quite fast enough, they usually require it.
I get the tag scan so I can talk radiology into doing it. So that's the use that we have at our institution.
Well, and at my institution, they want a CTA prior to almost any angiography, even even in the setting of a concern for a pancreatic leak with a massive bleed, they want a CTA, which is different from how I trained. So they want CTA where I am. It's almost impossible to get a tagged red cell scan, and they take so darn long in an emergency setting that I think that in that setting there really is no role for them. But sometimes a useful, sometimes on those images, if you can localize the bleed, you can have the radiologist continue to follow, even if the bleeding has been found, and you can see, you can watch the blood travel through the gut and get a sense of maybe it's small bowel or maybe it's colon. But the localization is really poor with the tag scans.
I have a question for the group. Do any of you have a hybrid OR suite where with some patient with massive bleeding have the ability to take the patient to the hybrid room and actually use a vascular surgeon colleague for embolization of the bleeding?
I've been in that setting. I've done provoked studies. I've never actually provoked a bleed. I don't really recommend it.
Yes, sir.
It's a question. Rahim Alawash is from Halifax, Canada. A middle-aged man, massive GI bleed, diverticulosis related. After two or three days, everything went well, went home. Any further management?
I assume he's had a colonoscopy to make sure it is a diverticular bleed, not a cancer. That's one thing, is bleeding is cancer until we prove otherwise. So assuming that he's had a colonoscopy, the majority of patients with a single diverticular bleed do not have a recurrent bleed, so they do not need surgery or angiography. I put them on fiber. I put everybody on fiber.
Regardless of age?
Regardless of age.
So when we all sat down and talked about what we were going to discuss, one of the things that we felt was important was what to do in the middle of the night when you're thinking about making a stoma and you don't have anybody around to help you out. And it can be a gut-wrenching experience to try to figure out where you're going to make this thing. A couple of days ago, there was a very nice talk for about an hour and a half, so I'm certainly not going to take that much time to go over it with you. But I do think that there are a couple of important points to take to heart in the middle of the night when your wound ostomy care nurses are not there and they're not able to come in and actually get the patient marked. Patients are also going to be unstable. It's going to be difficult to stand them up. It's going to be difficult to sit them up in the bed. So you really have to have some good tips and tricks on figuring out where to go. I think it's always important to draw out the triangles on either side from the iliac crest to the symphysis pubis and then down, or excuse me, up to the umbilicus. And always remember to think about it as a box and to try to get your stoma site at least 2 inches away. And a nice marker for 2 inches is that little single-use alcohol prep pad. When you look at the flanges on the end of the ostomy appliance, you want to make sure it's not going to be over a wound or not in a body fold or a crease. So those are all things to remember because it can lead to pouching issues later on and really affect the patient's quality of life after you've finished operating on them. So it's important to pinch, poke, and prod. Try to wrinkle their skin, look for dark lines. If you can sit them up while they're in the gurney, that would be great. And sometimes it's important to mark several places. So occasionally you'll see somebody laying down flat and something looks good on the images on the left. And then as soon as you sit them up, the bottom dot, I would think, would not be the appropriate one. But then once you sit them up, you can tell that that's clearly where the stoma needs to be. And then on the left-hand side, you see the boxes that were drawn out for the stoma. And the patient looks fine when they're sitting and when they're standing. I'm sorry, when they're laying down and when they're standing. But at the bottom image, you see that bottom box has actually disappeared. And we're actually having to go higher than the triangle that you normally would think about, especially in an obese abdomen. So just remember that it needs to be in a place where the patients can see them, where they can take care of them. It needs to be in a place where it's not going to be in a body fold so that you don't get a lot of skin irritation, so that you'll have better outcomes from it, and hopefully the patient will get back to you so that you can get rid of it. So moving on to some case presentations. We've heard some really nice case presentations, but I thought I would go with some stumpers. And unfortunately, whenever you think about giving one of these talks, that's when all these things roll in through your ER. So I had the benefit of taking care of a really nice 75-year-old guy who had a sigmoid colon cancer that was eating into his anterior rectus sheath. And so we presented him a tumor board. He was not obstructed at the time, and we felt that he would be a good candidate for chemotherapy and radiation. So in the process of getting everything set up, unfortunately he shows up in my ER even after appropriate counseling with the family to call me if anything happens. And it says 3 days, but it was really more like 5 days that he languished at home, not having bowel movements or passing gas. And you can see on his scalp film, because he came in from my ER, that colon is pretty dilated. And then on the cross-sectional images, you can see the transverse colon, you can see the right colon, left colon, everything's dilated, and then again, the mass that's eating into the rectus muscle. So when you approach an area, you gotta make a decision one way or another. And I'll be curious from the panel what y'all would do. Angela?
So I guess, how's he doing?
He is now doing great. But at the time, he had a tense abdomen. He was stable, but he was in a lot of pain.
And did you have the sense that the pain was from the tumor itself or from the obstruction?
It was from his colonic distension.
Okay. So
mildly tachycardic. So I'll set the stage.
Okay. So it's not an unreasonable location to consider a stent if you can get somebody to do that. But you have to have a real conversation with the patient about what that means and what the implication is going to be. I would also really consider looking at that colon, just taking him to the operating room and resecting. I think that would be the standard of care, would be to take him to the operating room. I think messing around with stents, waiting for an advanced endoscopist to become available to place a stent in a case like this can be really risky for progression to perforation. And so you have to be very careful about that, with the understanding that the gold standard in this case is to go to the operating room and, if possible, resect the tumor or proximally divert.
Moving down the line.
Yeah, did you say he's already on chemotherapy or not?
Getting ready to, no, not, no. Just 5FU.
Yeah. So I would try to resect it, but it looks dicey. You know, it's the ureter is going to be right there, the abdominal wall. So you're not going to get an R0 resection, which is, you know, what you would want. So the problem with proximally diverting him is the colon is gigantic, and so it's going to be challenging to bring that up. But and the other thing is, again, going back to consider the subsequent operation, what you don't want to do is give him a transverse loop colostomy distal to the middle colic artery, because then when you do go back and resect, you're going to take the IMA in the left colic, and you're going to have to probably resect all the way up to that ostomy. So I would try to resect it if I could. If I couldn't, I would do a proximal ostomy, but make sure it's proximal to the middle colic to keep the preservation of that blood supply.
Just one other comment. If you do resect these and they're eating into surrounding structures, it's really helpful in the long run if you leave clips in the resection bed, so on the anterior rectus there, because he's probably going to eventually have a recurrence there. And if he's going to be radiated or have it resected, it's helpful to know where the initial lesion was.
Any other comments?
I think with the abdominal pain that you're describing in this CT scan, I'd be very worried about ischemia and the cecum. And I probably would not even mess around with a stent or anything like that. I think this patient needs to be explored. And again, I would do my best not to mess with the tumor. I'd stay far away from it. I think long-term oncologic survival for this patient is getting him diverted in any way that you can, and then getting him back on some neoadjuvant therapy and then proceeding to resection.
I agree with that. I would do my best to stay away from that tumor and get it to neoadjuvant treatment first before I'd consider resection. His best shot is to do an oncologic resection with negative margins, and that's not going to happen in the middle of the night trying to like figure out where the tumor is and where the wall is. So a stent would really also worry me, also because of the impending perforation or ischemia, but also when it's attached to the abdominal wall, I think the risk of perforation turning this guy that has a locally advanced tumor but not necessarily metastatic, so we can go for cure for him, turning this into a perforated cancer would be a big problem. So I would go to the operating room, I'd explore him, I would try to do as distal of a colostomy as possible. And what I tend to do, especially because these colons are always so humongous, is create a purse string with a suture, decompress the air in the stool at the time of the colostomy creation to try to get that down as small as possible, controlling it, but bringing up that purse string as the colostomy. So that's just a trick that I try to do. But I would try to do this as distal as I could without pulling tension on the on the tumor, with plans for the subsequent resection, like Tracy was mentioning. So
I was able to listen to some of you, but not all of you, unfortunately. And by the time we got in, the colon was too large to really be able to work around it. So sometimes in these settings, similar to doing a purse string suture, I'll actually use the corrugated tubing that comes with our whisper suction, and actually use some, tied that into the colon and decompressed 5 liters of stool. And then we had some serosal injuries on the cecum as well as on the descending colon, fairly close to where the tumor was. So I had to pretty much just widen up, doing a total colectomy down to the rectum, and we were able to get margins on it, surprisingly, along with some vas deferens. So now he's doing all right. So moving on, not so an acute setting, there's a 64-year-old who came in after having a distal pancreatectomy for adenocarcinoma about 6 years ago, and then unfortunately was found to have a recurrence. In the process of getting worked up, was felt to be unresectable by the surgical oncologist that saw her, and then started developing obstructive symptoms. They did an EUS up and around where that lesion is and took biopsies and confirmed that it was a pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And then a gastrograph and enema was done. This shows the left colon fills nicely. You get a little bit of a bird's beak that you can sort of see there. So now the question is, what are you going to do? You're going to get your team together. You're going to figure out what's going to make a good wedding present. Try to figure out how to take care of this person. We can start at the other end of the table. First, she'll be last.
So this is an obstruction from secondary to recurrent pancreatic cancer.
Yes, ma'am.
That's right. All right. So I think we need to know more information about the recurrence of the pancreatic cancer, if this is local or is there any evidence of distant metastasis that would really, or in lymph nodes, that would really kind of dictate how the life expectancy for the patient with a chemotherapy or additional treatment. So, the easiest answer would be to bring up a diverting colostomy proximal to the obstruction and then get them to either further workup or to chemotherapy and treatment with plans to possibly do a curative resection if that would be deemed okay by a different surgical oncologist.
The patient didn't necessarily have lymph node disease, but they were felt to be unresectable from this lesion. With any kind of good outcome.
Yeah, I mean, you can also try a stent. I think the splenic flexure is a tough place, and they talk about that. It's a little bit tough at the flexures with acute angles. Stents are much more difficult to place. Yep. So I'd probably go for the same plan.
I think the fact that this has been deemed, if you trust your surgical oncologist, that this is a unresectable pancreatic recurrence, then you're looking at palliative options for this patient. I probably wouldn't do a stent just because it could be in there for a while. This is a patient that I think you could consider actually a bypass procedure on. So swinging the transverse to the sigmoid or the transverse to the descending and doing a colonastomosis to bypass that area. That's actually probably what would be my, what's gonna make the most sense in terms of palliating this without creating too much more of an issue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, and I think it depends on the operative findings. I've had this scenario twice, and the first time there was just a lot of carcinomatosis, and I think in that situation the best thing is just to proximally divert. If you think the patient's going to live for quite a long time, and they're relatively healthy, and want to avoid a stoma, I think a bypass is a really good option.
When you do the bypass, do you do mucus fistulas or you just transect just very close to the tumor?
No, just a side-to-side anastomosis, kind of like a gastrogegenostomy. Don't take anything out.
But when you leave the tumor, so I can leave the tumor in place.
You leave the tumor in place, bring and you just basically swing the transverse down to either the sigmoid or the descending.
Okay.
usually the sigmoid because it's floppy and it'll actually sit pretty nice next to the transverse. And then I do a colo-colo hand sewn anastomosis.
Thank you.
You definitely don't want to staple anything because then you're creating a closed loop obstruction with that tumor. So definitely the side to side, leaving everything else open.
Just one comment on stents, and I get this question a lot. In practice, they anecdotally don't work as well for malignant extrinsic compression, so metastatic tumors. They work better with primary colon. And then the other thing that I don't think we touched on very well is they really don't work well for benign strictures. They tend to migrate a lot in that setting and don't relieve the obstructions as well. So for things like diverticular strictures, there's really, and IBD strictures, there's really very little role for stents.
This is one of the reasons why I always like having other people's opinions, because you get to see the wide variance of different options that we have and the great ways that we have of taking care of people. In this instance, we actually were able to, or I wasn't, this is from a friend of mine, he was able to get a stent pass. The image on the left is before putting the stent in. You can sort of see a little opening at the top right aspect, and then afterwards you got the stent in and you can see some stools already starting to come out at you. And then on the post-stenting images, it was right at the splenic flexure, which again is a very tricky area to try to get around. It takes a lot of skill and has a high risk of perforation. And then again, I think it's a very good point that when you have an external cancer, it's not a primary colon cancer, there is a lot of external compression and stents don't always work in these scenarios. But in this case, she was able to get the stent and she's now on chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer. I appreciate everybody's time. I think we've filled our slot. Thank you very much.